This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscawain, sitting in for Terry Gross. In 1994, after a bloody civil war in Rwanda, hundreds of thousands of Hutu refugees fled their country to neighboring Zaire. They settled in sprawling, desperate camps along the Rwandan border. Now, 2 years later, after fighting has thrown the region into chaos, those refugees are on the move once again, looking for food and shelter. After days of deliberation, a Canadian-led international force is making plans to intervene in Zaire, and yesterday, President Clinton tentatively agreed to send in American troops. Today on Fresh Air, two perspectives from the front lines. We'll hear from Philip Gurevich, who's reporting on the situation for The New Yorker in just a few minutes. But first, we talk about the current humanitarian crisis with Chris Cushing, Regional Emergency Coordinator for CARE International, stationed in Kigali, Rwanda. Fighting broke out in eastern Zaire at the end of October, and Cushing says the violence forced organizations like CARE to suspend their programs. There's been fighting in Goma, Zaire today, and Cushing says the refugees are in extremely dire circumstances.
All the camps have been destroyed, and so all the population is moving on the lava fields of Goma, on the escarpment in the heavy forest. The one camp that is still at least intact is Mugunga Camp, which is 40 minutes west of Goma town itself. The front line passed through Mugunga Camp over the last couple of days, and we now believe it's almost to the town of Saki, which is at the end of the one road that exists in this part of Kivu province. The refugees and the internally displaced are the numbers themselves are staggering. We're looking at 700,000 or 800,000 refugees before the fighting started in the camps in this area. They have all moved. There were 400,000 to 600,000 in Mugunga camp over the weekend. Some have remained there. Our understanding from, again, very scanty reports is that a lot of the bulk of the population has moved under the control of the extremists around the corner of the lake, and they're sort of setting up a last stand there. A lot of other people are fleeing west over the escarpment and into the heavy jungles. People have been showing up 800 kilometers west of Goma in a town called Kisangani, and they've been going as far north as Sudan and as far south as Zambia and Angola. So the flows, the population and refugee flows that are a result of the fighting of the last couple of weeks are absolutely staggering. We figured that the food ran out for these people last week. During the last 2 or 3 weeks of the evacuations of Uvira, Bukavu, and Goma, our staff were trying to distribute as much of the food as possible, which was in the warehouses in these regions. We figured that food ran out at least by the weekend. But our major concern is that when we have populations of 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 people basically lying together on a lava field or in the jungle without proper water and without proper sanitation, then you have the problem of measles, cholera, and dysentery, which burn through populations like this, like a forest fire. And so, you know, the death toll in 1994 in Goma, the death toll was 50,000 people alone in a few days from cholera and dysentery and measles. These are the first killers which come up within a couple of days when populations are in these kind of conditions. It's also the rainy season here, so it's the equivalent of the winter for the African people that we would be facing at home. It's raining every day. It's very cold. They've already been malnourished for a couple of years because of the very low rations we've been able to provide for them in the refugee camps. And in addition to that, they've had maybe 5 or 6 weeks of heavy fighting and running and hiding in woods and in the lava fields which surround this area. So their condition is absolutely stark. One of the things we're really worried about is that if this multinational force does take 10 days or 20 days to get together and be deployed, the problem will probably be over, you know, for most of these people. They just don't have that much time.
We'll hear more from Chris Cushing about the humanitarian efforts in Zaire later in the program. He's the regional coordinator for CARE International. Philip Gurevich has been writing about the crisis in Rwanda and Zaire for The New Yorker magazine. He's currently in the region doing research for a forthcoming book about the 1994 Rwandan Civil War, in which more than 800,000 people were massacred. We spoke to him yesterday from Kigali, Rwanda, about the complex politics surrounding the current efforts to help the refugees. The Rwandans are reluctant to go back to their homeland. Gurevich says that many fear that if they do go back to Rwanda, they'll be killed. What makes the problem worse, he says, is that the refugees are being controlled by military leaders responsible for genocide.
The camps have been controlled from the very start by the armed perpetrators of an enormous genocide. And that's been recognized by the entire humanitarian community. And nevertheless, they've just decided they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to deal with it. They lacked the spine or the muscle to confront this problem. And so they continued to feed a crisis that was inevitable. For 2 years now, since those camps were set up, it was foreseen that at some point, these armed elements, which were preventing the people in the camps from returning to Rwanda and were preparing to fight another battle, rearming in Zaire, they seemed to be extremely well-armed, were sort of controlling this situation and making these refugee camps into a rump Rwandan state run by the genociders. And now they're back in uniform, manning a front line, and behind them are the refugees. So that I really like to look at this situation less as a traditional refugee humanitarian crisis than as the largest hostage crisis in history.
Then looking at the refugee camps that are in Zaire, what you have are essentially Hutus who fled from Rwanda after their 1994 civil war, many of them staying there because they feared reprisals from the government in Rwanda, the government that they left. Among these, then, refugees are ex-military men from Rwanda, Hutus, who really were responsible for a lot of the genocide that took place then in that 1994 civil war in Rwanda. Are you saying, then, that the legitimate refugees in Zaire who fled from Rwanda are really being held captive by other Hutus who also fled Rwanda, who also happened to be part of the genocide that took place 2 years ago?
Well, maybe it would be helpful if I just back up for a minute and explain some of the history, the broad outlines of the history. What happened in 1994 in Rwanda was that the state, the government, was following an ideology of Hutu extremism. It was an ideology that was essentially defined by ethnicity, and was the majority of the population in Rwanda have always been Hutus. And the government set in motion this genocide, where really the objective was to exterminate the entire Tutsi population, about 1.25 million people. And in order to do this with relatively crude implements, mostly machetes and clubs and some guns, they needed to enlist the entire population in this. This was a process that went on for really literally decades, the sort of slow preparation of this ideology and the process that led up to the implementation of the genocide. The radio was an enormous factor in all of this. Throughout the genocide and before it, there were extensive broadcasts basically instructing and directing the slaughter of Tutsis. And at a certain point, as the rebel army that took over Rwanda, fighting a civil war at the same time as the genocide was going on, and now represents the sort of backbone of the current government. As this army came in and the genocide forces realized that they were losing the war, they changed their instructions to the population from kill to instructions to flee. And they very deliberately took with them as much of the population as they could persuade, so that the camps in Zaire, as well as the camps that have been in Tanzania and Burundi, were from the start really composed as much of fugitives, people fleeing prosecution, as people fleeing persecution. They were camps run by war criminals. The perception in the world was there was a genocide, and then there were refugees, and the assumption largely was people must be fleeing the fear of being killed. But in fact, many, the leaders of the people who ended up in the camps, and many of the people in the camps, were fleeing the scene of the crime which they had perpetrated. This was understood extremely clearly at the start. But then you had this massive population in exile, and they were suffering, especially at the beginning, from great diseases, and they were just, it was just no question about it, a humanitarian crisis. And the world rushed in and established these camps. They had no control over the life of these camps, the UN and the other agencies that were there. They were unable to disarm the people in the camps. No political will came forward when appeals were made to disarm these people. The Zairean government, which had always been allied with the genocidal government of Rwanda before, continued to facilitate the acquisition of arms and the training of the military. And so what you really have now, yes, is that there are women, there are children who are probably not in any way directly implicated in the genocide. There are men who may not be implicated in the genocide. There's a huge population there of people who are being held essentially as political captives, as hostages, one could say, although whether they're willing or unwilling followers is always unclear, in these, by the leaders of this utterly criminal and utterly murderous political movement.
My understanding is that something like 45% of the people in the camps are children under the age of 15. And I guess the question to the humanitarian community is, how do you feed refugees without feeding Hutu military leaders who may be responsible for genocidal acts in Rwanda?
Well, it's a kind of impossible conundrum, unless one is willing to recognize that you cannot have a purely humanitarian response to a genocide. A genocide is a vast crime, and it is also a political act. And to treat a political movement as strictly humanitarian, because there are children and vulnerable people who have been swept along by the perpetrators, essentially dodges the fact that if you keep feeding them, you're also feeding the perpetrators, and sooner or later there's going to be more slaughter. There's going to be another battle. So what was missing from the start in the international response was a willingness to militarily confront a military force. The leadership, the people who are holding the refugees behind them, are people who have to be confronted by force. It's the only language they speak. There is no meaningful way of getting in there. The only way to get access to this population that's vulnerable is to be prepared to confront with force the people who are holding them by force and who are committed to killing very directly. And so far, the fact is, nobody in the outside world has been prepared to take on the risks of such an operation, which mean not just firing, but being fired on. And it's an incredibly hideous scenario because, like any hostage crisis, you always, when you fire, run the risk of actually directly or indirectly triggering the deaths of the people you're trying to rescue, as well as the people you're trying to immobilize. And you also risk your own life. I mean, there's a very good chance that anybody who would take on such an operation would be killed. This is why the current discussions of a military intervention are proceeding, I suspect, quite a bit more slowly than they would if the only question was, say, feeding victims of a famine.
We're talking about the crisis in Zaire with Philip Gurevich, who's in neighboring Rwanda. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Philip Gurevich. We're talking about the crisis in Zaire. Let me ask you a logistical question, because humanitarian workers are now beginning to come back to Zaire. Some food and medical supplies is beginning to trickle into the country as well. This is a logistical question. My understanding is that there are problems of rain in the country, and that makes certain roads impassable. If the decision is to feed the refugees, how do they get the food and medical supplies to them under these circumstances?
The only direct means of access by proper roads and airports to the refugees is to go directly from Rwanda into Zaire, or to land in the airports within eastern Zaire in Goma and Bukavu, and that is through the rebel-controlled territory and then to the camps. It is raining here at this time of year. That means that you have about 2 hours of rain a day. When you're dealing with dirt roads or so, you're really dealing with mud roads. In order to get to these camps, that's not a problem for the moment, because the distances aren't huge from the paved roads and the access is very good from Rwanda. The problem is twofold. The government of Zaire does not want the rebels, whose concern is interior Zairean politics, whose concern is toppling the regime of Mobutu, they do not want the rebels to acquire recognition. The rebels now are in an interesting position. They've taken this area of eastern Zaire, and they control direct access to the camps. Not entirely. They control access to the front line. As I say, on the other side of that front line, it is the genocidal forces of the former Rwandan government army and militias who control access. But in order, in other words, to do business in that region, you have to do business with the rebels. Zaire is using all of its influence to prevent international agencies from doing so. International agencies, or nonetheless at least humanitarian agencies, are beginning to negotiate with the rebels terms of operating in that area. Simultaneously, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has come up with what is truly a bizarre and probably insane scheme of flying food into the city of Kisangani, which is about 500 miles through total jungle, into the center of Zaire. It is the sort of, it's the city basically where Conrad's Heart of Darkness ends and where V.S. Naipaul's A Bend in the River is set. It's a city accessible only by air and by riverboat. And there are some extremely bad, famously impassable roads which reach from that area rather indirectly towards the area in which the heaviest concentration of Rwandan refugees seem to be. The scheme is to fly food in massive quantities and to fly trucks into this place, and then to load up these trucks and to try to get through jungles that are famous for really trapping trucks for days on end in mud pits and, you know, the huge roots across the road. It's hard to imagine that this could possibly work. It also poses the problem that if it did succeed, it would suck the refugees further from the Rwandan border, deeper into Zaire in pursuit of the food that was being offered to them. Why it's happening is beyond me and beyond everyone I've been able to talk to here, including the officers of UNHCR around here seem to think it's an extremely bizarre notion. So when one hears about rain and so forth, what it really looks like is going on is that this UN agency is trying to appease the desire of the Zairean government to have its territorial integrity respected at a moment when a humanitarian crisis is taking place in a part of its country controlled by a rebel force.
This is a very complex conflict and a very complex situation for people to understand. But I think we need to get a little bit of a history on Zaire, which got its independence in 1960. It's headed by a dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko, who you described as the longest ruling despot in Africa. How has Zaire fared under the rule of Mobutu?
Well, it's been utterly devastated by the rule of Mobutu. The rule of Mobutu has been a rule of kleptocracy. The program has really been to keep the country from being able to organize itself. It has been regressive in every sense of the word. On the other hand, it's a country of enormous wealth, and its people are sort of famously persistent and good-spirited, so that if you enter places in Zaire, you don't always have the feeling of total destitution. But one of the things that Mobutu has done is he has recognized that running a million-square-mile country that doesn't particularly like the regime, and that contains, I think, something over 300 different ethnic and language groups, and that is really tremendously diverse, one of the ways to prevent being overthrown, that has really been the objective of his regime, is to prevent being overthrown. And he has done that by allowing what were tens of thousands of miles of navigable roads. Rather than developing the road system, he has let it absolutely go to seed, so that the country is not easily connected to other parts of the country, are inaccessible to other parts of the country, so that no rebellion and no communication is possible. There's no coherent phone system. There's no coherent mail system. What riverboats there were have been diminished to a few rusty hulks that run on a completely erratic schedule very infrequently. There's airplane service, and that immediately gets cut when there's any sort of an uprising. There's an army that is deliberately designed not to be able to stage a coup. That's the main objective. Not to be able to defend the country, but not to be able to stage a coup. So that there's always, it's been designed in such a way that that every battalion will be adversarially related to other battalions, that there will be intrigues and contests, and also that the soldiers have no incentive to fight because they're not particularly paid, they're not particularly taken care of, and they don't have any sense of loyalty, really, to a political system that never really stands up for them. So the country has fared very ill under Mobutu, and is a very deep vein of anti-Mobutist sentiment which any rebellion can tap into.
Both Zaire and Rwanda officials say that they want the refugees to go home. These are some of the public pronouncements that are made. But how seriously do you think officials want that to happen? And how would you, in a sense, force Rwandans to go back to their country, many of whom, of course, are afraid that if they do go back, something terrible is going to happen to them?
Well, to begin with, I think that the government of Rwanda is absolutely sincere about its desire to have the refugees home. And the way that their good faith can be measured is that whenever there have been significant repatriations, the people who return are not persecuted any more than the population that's here, which isn't to say that everybody here is terribly persecuted. It's difficult, it's difficult to entirely measure how it's going in every little rural area. But in the month of July, 80,000 Rwandese refugees were repatriated from Burundi. And the reports on their return indicate that they've been reassimilated, they've reclaimed their original homes, they've reassimilated. The arrest rate of people accused of genocide is lower than or at no point higher than the rate amongst the general population here. The population of Rwanda right now is overwhelmingly Hutu. The people in the camps have been deeply propagandized by their leaders who have a life and death, basically, commitment to separating Hutu and Tutsi and opposing the idea that the two can live integrated together. So what you really have is a government that at least preaches a line of integration and to a large degree has demonstrated reasonably good faith in attempting that in extremely bad odds after the genocide, opposing itself to an exiled army committed to divisionism. And so I think they really do want those people to come home, and I really do think that the fears of persecution are, however much basis they may have, they are totally incomparable to the suffering that the people are experiencing in exile.
We'll hear more from Philip Gurevich in the second part of the show. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Let's continue our interview with Philip Gurevich, who's been covering the crisis in Rwanda and Zaire for The New Yorker magazine. In the first part of our interview, we spoke about the difficult issue relief organizations are facing in Zaire. The irony is that the food and assistance they're providing to the camps may also be slowing down the repatriation process. I asked Gurevich if he would deny aid to the refugees in Zaire in order to encourage them to return to Rwanda.
At this point, I believe it would be the most humane thing to do. And I know that sounds like a harsh point of view, but the situation here is exceedingly harsh. And the need for a deeply realistic view of the situation. The international community has never shown a willingness to risk one of its own lives in any meaningful way in combat with the forces that commit genocide. It's only willing to come in and look at people who are victimized by those forces. And so it's looking at a situation that is political and military in terms that are completely unrelated to that situation. It essentially turns a blind eye to the fact that there's a brewing problem that none of its humanitarian assistance can address. And I think that, you know, we don't respect the legitimacy of wars sometimes. And I'm not advocating war, but what I'm saying is when we fight a war, we often think it's for a cause. And when people here fight a war in Africa or in the third world, there's often the perception that it's just people killing each other. It's just meaningless slaughter, and that it's an affront to our sense that people should behave themselves and not have wars and not create suffering that we then have to look at on our television sets. And I really very genuinely believe that in this case, there may be no perfectly good guys in the equation, but you have a completely criminal element fighting a war with a government that is attempting reconstruction, and that unless one accept the legitimacy of that government's efforts, the government of Rwanda that's currently trying to achieve a degree of reconstruction and has achieved it to a remarkable degree. One equalizes both sides in a conflict, and one comes in and says, nobody will ever suffer the full brunt of a war because we will essentially cater that war. We will send beans and blankets and we will send first aid. You'll never suffer your casualties because we'll take care of them. You will never be beaten. Why shouldn't they be beaten? They're criminals. I think that if this was in Europe, one would not say that a Nazi army should be catered.
Before the Canadians offered their plan, the French had a plan of intervention, which received a very lukewarm response. Why?
France essentially was a sponsor of the genocidal government of Rwanda. They provided arms. They literally provided fighting men in the early days of the civil war that led progressively towards the genocide. Son of President Mitterrand, was a great friend of the president here. He provided arms. He provided airplanes and so forth. There was an extremely close relationship. And towards the end of the genocide in Rwanda, France bullied the United Nations into allowing it to send what it called a UN-sponsored humanitarian mission into Rwanda. And that mission, called Operation Turquoise, came in and sealed off the area where the largest number of genocidal militiamen and army still existed inside Rwanda and allowed them to escape into Zaire. It protected the genociders. They continued to kill under French rule. It never arrested anybody. And it really turned out to be deeply complicitous. And politically, in terms of international lobbying and so forth, France has continued to respect its old sort of post-colonial, territorial attitude towards Africa. And it's been understood from the start to everybody who was looking at their current plan, which involved literally sort of, you know, massive armed invasion, that probably what they would do is they would go in and defend the very forces that everybody wants to see defeated here.
So the world was right to be very skeptical.
Absolutely. I mean, France has to be stood up to in Africa and stared down very hard. They've caused untold mischief and enormous suffering. And it was quite interesting. At a press conference that I was at in Goma, Zaire, last week, the rebel leader was asked by a French reporter, "Do you have a message for the French President Chirac?" And in a paraphrase, I can say that what he said was, "Oh, do I have a message for President Chirac? President Chirac, you have caused enough suffering by propping up the dictatorships in this area of Africa. I cannot believe that the French people support the suffering of the people of Africa on the level that the French government has inflicted it. Stop it. Get out of the way. Don't do it anymore." It was very strong. And that sentiment is shared across a huge swath of French-speaking Africa.
Philip Gurevich, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Philip Gurevich is in Kigali doing research on a book on the aftermath of the Rwandan Civil War. He's been writing about the crisis in Rwanda and Zaire for The New Yorker magazine. The international relief organization CARE has been working in Central Africa for 25 years, providing food and medicine to refugees and working with countries there on social and economic development. CARE is just one of several relief groups who have been working with the Rwandan refugees who fled to Zaire after the 1994 civil war. The total number of refugees in camps in Zaire is estimated to be 1.1 million. As Philip Gurevich told us, some of them are Hutu military, who are directly responsible for the genocide which took place during the 1994 civil war. I asked Chris Cushing, Regional Emergency Coordinator for CARE International, if CARE is concerned with feeding them along with legitimate refugees.
Yes, very much. And in fact, our policy since we entered the refugee situation in eastern Zaire was not to deal with the camps that involved the military. Now, that's easy to say. In fact, all the camps had some elements of either the Interahamwe or people who just participated in the genocide or the actual, you know, professional military in them, as well as the political elite, which had also led the genocide. But some of the camps were clearly identifiable. They were what we called full military camps. And those were the ones that nobody really tried to touch. The unfortunate thing, of course, is that these extremists did control the entire refugee population. When the refugees left Rwanda, what should have been done is that the border guards or the border customs people should have disarmed the soldiers. Instead, partly because of the influx was so huge, you know, hundreds of thousands of people a day crossing over, but also because of the political alliances in the region, these groups were allowed to come out intact. And in fact, just by the time we sort of arrived on the scene to start administering aid, they were the entire communes, entire prefectures had come out with their political and military arrangements and structures. And so by the time we got there, we did try to separate, you know, what we've been calling the sheep from the wolves, but it was extremely difficult. An example I can give you is in one of our camps near Bukavu, where we were running one of the sectors in the camps was education. And Les Scout, the Boy Scouts, who were part of the Interahamwe who had been carrying out the genocide, these were kids who wanted to take over some of the school training so they could train new soldiers for the next, you know, genocide in 10 or 15 years. And we had a very difficult time in the camp because we were trying to promote the women's association, some of the other non-military associations, to do the education program. And at the beginning, of course, you know, these kids are basically killing whoever we're trying to put up to balance them. And it ended up in the first couple of months that we had to give them, you know, one classroom of their own children they could teach and run the school for.
But then over the course of the year, what we were able to do was reduce that down and eventually sort of slowly move them out of the education sector, hand that over to two or three of the non-military, you know, the women's associations, the teachers association and stuff, who did carry on the education component of the camp, running the schools, the grade schools, the high schools, and we were effectively able to sort of reduce that. But I know several times I'd have to be called out from either the region or from one of the offices to go to the camp because, you know, a woman leader had been killed by the Interahamwe in the camp. They were everywhere.
Is CARE concerned that by feeding and housing and clothing and providing school and medical assistance to refugees in camps in Zaire, that's actually preventing Rwandans from going back to their country?
We're concerned about it. It's one of the major issues now in the humanitarian field. I guess in looking at it, we have to understand that humanitarian agencies, that's what they do. They provide humanitarian assistance to reduce suffering, to lower mortality rates, to try to help people exist in refugee camps or internal camps, whatever their terrible situation is, until they can return to a normal life. What we have to understand is that the conflicts these people are involved in are political conflicts involving social, economic, and political factors. Humanitarian agencies are not political actors. Granted, our aid does have an effect, either positive or negative, in a conflict cycle. But what you really need are political strategies by political actors, the international community or the warring factions, to try to resolve the political conflict that started this problem. And so what we've been calling for repeatedly for the last 2 years, and for several years before that, of course, is that in situations like Bosnia and Somalia, the international community cannot simply provide humanitarian aid and think that that will solve the problems or deal with the political problems that resulted in the conflict. What you need are particular political strategies by political actors to deal with the political problems. The humanitarian side is just really dealing with the symptoms of the conflict, and yet the international community does not want to get involved in these dirty wars in Bosnia, Somalia, Rwanda. And that's really where the major problem lies.
Our other guest on Fresh Air today believes and really says that humanitarian groups like CARE should take drastic measures and, in a sense, force repatriation in the camps in Zaire by stopping aid. I mean, in stark terms, he says, perhaps it's time to starve the people back to Rwanda. What's your response to that?
Well, you hear that expression stated quite often. I would think that that's not exactly a very humane type of situation. The main problem with when we're looking at the population in eastern Zaire, we've really got two major groups, the sort of innocent civilians who are being held in terror by the extremist groups who are controlling them. And this control was present in Rwanda before the genocide. It was present there during the genocide, and it's been controlling them in the last 2 years in the camps. What when we're talking about repatriation, it's a principle of international law, and it's a principle of humanitarian law that you cannot force people to go back into a country where they believe they'll be killed or where they don't feel secure. I mean, the reason they left the country is because they think they'll be killed or they're being persecuted. Now, the problem, of course, is that for the last 2 years, during the genocide and before the war, the only information a lot of the innocent civilian people have had has been the propaganda of the extremists. The international community has not been able to, and the moderates on the other side have not been able to pass on what we would call, let's say, the truth or a balanced view, saying that, sure, there are problems in Rwanda, but in fact, it may be safe enough to go back. And so, humanitarian agencies, again, have our first calling is for the humanitarian side, the human rights side of this. And while we believe that the final solution for this has to be that the people return to their home country and try to, rebuild their lives and start living again, is it really respecting their human rights, their rights to either make them so sick that they're too weak to put up a struggle and you cart them back and throw them over the border? Do you point a gun at them and force them back? People in these kind of conditions are not going to go back voluntarily like that. You have to educate them that, what the lies they've been told for the last 5 years, 6 years are not the truth, and that, you know, that maybe there is a different situation over there which they're not aware of, and then they will return of their own free will.
We're talking to you from Kigali, Rwanda. Can you say that it's safe for Hutus to return to their country?
From the general reports I've read, and again, I've been mostly focusing on Liberia and Zaire side and stuff like this, but from what I understand from the Rwandan government statements and from mostly what's happened over the last couple of years, and we have had an example where there was a forced repatriation out of Burundi in the last while. Generally, there are minor incidents, but it seems that the people coming back, they may be investigated, they may be held without detention or with detention. I mean, certainly there are problems in the Rwandan justice system, but generally the feeling is that they can return. The question, of course, lies in the fact that the government probably wants, you know, the farmers back, the sort of innocent civilians. What happens with the other people, the fighters, and the political leadership who led the genocide? What should have been done in 94 and wasn't is that we have to distinguish, again, the wolf from the sheep. And we have to say that, you know, some people are legitimate refugees and try to identify them. And we have to acknowledge that the others are either war criminals or are indicted as such. And they have to be tried under the laws of Rwanda or international law, and therefore they're not open to refugee status and repatriation home. But that, of course, I mean, the numbers we're talking about are staggering. You know, hundreds of thousands of people involved in that. And, of course, Rwanda was completely destroyed by the war itself. The judges, the judicial system, the buildings, the lawyers, all the people were killed, and the judicial system just fell apart. They haven't had a lot of aid or assistance to try to rebuild that. They've had some. Some countries have made quite a contribution to that, but there's still so far to go. And, of course, without the reconciliation or the pursuit of justice being that visible, the jails are full, the trials are very slow, there doesn't seem to be always an inclination that justice will be served.
What do you think of the idea that some have offered that instead of delivering foodstuffs directly to the camps in Zaire, put the food literally just inside the border of Rwanda, thereby luring Hutus back to their own country?
This strategy, we're calling it the pull strategy, to pull them into Rwanda, has been suggested by a number of agencies and been discussed. The problem were that may or may not have worked before the current crisis. Certainly the fact is that the refugees over the last couple of years have been living in absolutely terrible conditions in eastern Zaire. And if they felt they could return, that it was safe to return to Rwanda, they probably would have, whether there's food piled up on the border as a magnet or not. But right now the situation we're dealing with is that the entire border area is a buffer zone controlled by a rebel group, a coalition of rebel groups, who have fought the Zaire military in the region and pushed the refugees westward from the border. And so if you were now to take food into Rwanda or Burundi and put it on the border, these refugees who are still afraid of Rwanda and Burundi would have to cross through a buffer zone patrolled by a rebel group which has just displaced them and fought with them, and then they would have to go into Rwanda, which they're scared of anyways. So that kind of strategy had been talked about before the current crisis, and it was flawed because, again, it didn't deal with sort of the political reality these people will leave in the camp areas themselves.
My guest is Chris Cushing of the relief organization CARE. We're talking about the Rwandan refugee crisis in Zaire. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Chris Cushing of CARE. Yesterday, Canada said it would lead an international force to provide protection to refugees in Zaire. President Clinton has tentatively agreed to send in U.S. troops. I asked Cushing what CARE would like these forces to accomplish.
Well, we're hearing different versions of what the mandate's going to be, and I understand the discussions are still underway, but clearly, for a politically responsible intervention to come in, what has to take place is a disarmament of the warring factions of the fighters if they're still in control of the civilian population. To just come in and provide an area of sanctuary and then a corridor where people can come back into Rwanda without dealing with the terrorists who've been controlling them, no one's going to cross into the sanctuary. No one's going to go down the corridor. These people are being held, they're being terrorized into submission by the political elite, which has been running them for several years. And until you can dislodge them from that elite, from that hold, you're not going to get them back in. And so that's our main concern, is that if a multinational force goes in with either a specific mandate not to get involved in disarming the factions, then you know, what's it coming in for? There's no refugees are going to come back to this humanitarian corridor, and we're not really sure the purpose. Of course, we have to realize there's a heavy, heavy cost in going into these areas and trying to, you know, a lot of these fighters are going to put up a fight. Casualties will be taken on both sides, and of course, the innocent civilians will probably be caught in the middle of these firefights. So it's an incredibly messy situation. If the extremists are still in control of the civilian population, which we understand from the very scanty information we do have coming out, is still likely the case.
Can you say, though, to the president and to the American people that coming into Zaire, what you're predicting is that in order for a multinational force to be effective, they're really going to have to fight and engage some of these Hutu militias, that people are going to die? Are you saying that that this situation is worth American deaths?
Well, it depends on the value of a human life. If the United States or Canada or other countries who live fairly prosperous lives and who claim some sort of hold on international leadership of the community, if countries are going to say, you know, we stand up for certain values, then I think you have to make sacrifices sometimes to uphold those values. We certainly did in World War I and II, Korea, other wars that have gone on. There are times when the international community has to stand up and say that the situation here is not tolerable, and maybe we have to pay a price to go in and try to help other people. Again, the majority of the people who are caught in eastern Zaire in this terrible circumstance, whether they're Burundian refugees, Rwandan refugees, or internally displaced Zaire people themselves, are completely innocent. They haven't asked for any of this. And certainly as an aid worker who's worked in front lines from Sarajevo to Rwanda to Georgia, you know, what brings me back is the goodness of the innocent people who are caught in these terrible circumstances. I've got a niece who's 6 years old in Canada, and I've got a nephew who's 3 years old. And I would pray that if they were ever in the circumstances of these people, that someone would come out and try to help them.
Chris Cushing is my guest. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with my guest, Chris Cushing, Regional Emergency Coordinator for CARE in Rwanda and Zaire. Chris, tell us what you did today.
Oh, today. Well, I'm the regional coordinator, and I'm working with three other CARE emergency coordinators under me. We're doing several things. We are keeping a watch on the border, negotiating with the local authorities in Rwanda and the rebel commanders on the other side for access. We are mobilizing CARE's international resources, both national staff, international staff from, you know, we've got 11 or 12 CARE chapters. We're bringing people on standby, emergency teams into the region to be prepared to go in as soon as we're able to. We're fundraising with donors. We're meeting with other NGOs. We're forming alliances with. We've got alliances now with two other NGOs, again, major players in this field, and we're negotiating with another four so that when we are able to get in, that there won't be that sort of competitive frenzy that we saw in 1994, which was, you know, quite disgraceful. And what we're trying to do is match up so that if we're going to do, let's say, the logistics and something, someone else will do the public health, someone else will do water sanitation, someone else will do food distribution. So we're trying to, in a way, we're lucky that the insecurity is so bad that we don't have access into the region, because it's giving us a week or 10 days where we can organize ourselves and we don't have to sort of hit the ground running. As it is, as soon as we get across the border, the teams will be flying in, the equipment and all the material will be flowing in to try to save as many lives as possible. But that's been the normal days. The days are about 20-hour days. We're sharing an office with our CARE Rwanda mission, which is a sort of a development reintegration mission here. And I mean, I'm very lucky. I've got seven or eight very experienced professional staff I'm working with, and we've got a lot of cooperation from Atlanta, where CARE USA is headquartered, Ottawa, where my own CARE Canada is headquartered. We're on the phone with donors, politicians, other agencies. It's long days. It's been a long 2 weeks.
Oh, I can imagine. I'm curious when care workers go into Zaire itself, which is obviously a dangerous and volatile situation, how are they protected? How do they protect themselves?
Well, hopefully you've got experienced people going in, and you And it's just, you know, you go in under sort of a white flag. Hopefully the warring factions have identified, you know, that you're not a soldier, you're not a bad guy. That doesn't always actually make a difference. Some quite often we are the target, either we're held hostage or something else. Basically what you try to do is negotiate access with as many of the factors that you're going to have to deal with as possible. So again, I spent the weekend, just walking up to the border at Goma and talking to the local commander, trying to say, you know, again, they know who we are, but explaining what we want to do, the terms of access we'd be looking for, trying to get information on what he understands is the situation on his side, and basically negotiating our way through. That is the problem with that, of course, is that if the warring factions are continuing to fight and they don't want assistance into the region, we're not going to get in. You know, we don't have tanks and guns and bombs that we can fight our way in. That's not how we do it. So we have to wait until the warring factions either decide they're going to allow us in or until they kill themselves and we can come in after and try to pick up the remnants.
Are there any lessons from this conflict?
Lessons from the conflict. I'm sure there's about a million of them. What we have learned, I think we've learned the lesson of 94. And certainly with the coordination team that CARE is putting together here and in the discussions we're having with other NGOs and UN agencies, the major theme that I've certainly been pushing and my people have been pushing is that we have to be politically responsible. We cannot turn a blind eye to the political aspects of our work or to the politics of the conflict that's going on. I'm actually quite confident. I'm surprised, having been only here a couple of weeks, how much we've seen to have moved from 1994, from Bosnia, from other conflicts. So far, you know, I think we're on the right track as far as designing strategies which are going to reduce the negative effects of assistance, and which are going to support those strategies which will lead to a long-term reconciliation. It's still early days. I mean, we've only been in place 2 or 3 weeks with our coordination center and our first field team in place to set up our programs. But so far, you know, it's a significant difference over even a couple of years ago. So, I mean, there are a lot of lessons in operations and planning and in cooperation with other actors. I'm actually optimistic for what we've been through over the last couple of weeks. And if we can maintain that kind of heading, I think we'll do okay.
Chris Cushing, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Chris Cushing is Regional Emergency Coordinator for the relief organization CARE. He spoke to us from his base in Kigali, Rwanda.